Hey guys, this is Mike Mahaffey, the old bastard BJJ guy, here for BJJ Metal Models. Back in my day, we had to walk uphill in the snow both ways to get to the academy just to learn some crappy technique from a random purple belt. You kids have it so easy, because now you can just subscribe to BJJ Metal Models Premium and get tons of great audio courses to learn new techniques, enhance your mindset, and entertain yourself. You can even get personalized rolling reviews from some of your favorite BJJ Metal Models coaches, including me. It's like having your own seminar, you spoiled little whippersnappers. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to BJJ Metal Models Premium right now, get off my lawn, and go train.
Hey, welcome to BJJ Metal Models, episode 281. I am Steve Kwan. BJJ Mental Models is your guide to a conceptual and intelligent jiu-jitsu approach. And today I'm back with the doctor of kick-ass, Mr. Mike Bakarski, or Dr. Mike Bakarski, I guess. How's it going, Mike?
How's it going? It's been a while. I don't remember the last time we've talked, but it's been a minute.
It has been a while. You still haven't told me where you got your doctorate in kick-ass from, man. I'm curious.
Well, I guess it's a self-title, but no one's taken it from me yet, so I think I'm good.
So you didn't find some like clinic in Barbados that offers this weird, obscure doctorate?
No. You know, ironically, this is actually hilarious. So, you know, Alexander Karelin, like the famous Greco-Roman Olympian, he has a doctorate. And, you know, I was like, look, I was curious. I was like, oh, I wonder what it is. His doctorate is in the suplex. That's ridiculous. Like, if that's true, that is ridiculous. Like, literally, he studied the suplex so much, he got his doctorate in it.
So did he do like a double-blind peer-reviewed clinical study on the suplex? How does this work?
I didn't look into too much detail, but I read that. I was like, I don't know if this is true, but it's hilarious if it is.
Well, you know what? We might get a doctorate in the stack pass after this conversation, my friend. Yeah. So for those who don't know, Mike is a longtime friend of the show, hangs out in our Discord quite a bit. He's been on the podcast before talking about return to sport after injury. Mike probably best known as one of the main sports recovery influencers in the BJJ space on Instagram. If you don't know him by his real name, Mike Pekarski, you might know him by the handle Dr. Kickass, which is the name of his Instagram account. But Mike, did I miss anything? Anything else you want to add there in the introduction?
No, I think that pretty much covers it. If people ask, so my actual credentials, I'm a doctor of physical therapy. So for the Canadian folk, it's physio or around the world. So that is what my true doctorate degree is in.
And also a black belt under Henry Akins, I believe, right?
Yeah, I was technically I'm his first black belt. I mean, another guy was promoted at the same time, but I'm still saying that I was the first black belt.
Awesome. Well, great lineage, man. And awesome to have you back again. This conversation came up because we've been talking for a long time about getting you back on here. And something that emerged in our conversations where you might be uniquely qualified to help is understanding how to do the stack pass safely. The stack pass, of course, is, at least in my mind, one of the most essential passing and even control strategies from attacking the guard. And really, everyone should have a great stack pass. But there's no denying that, especially at the junior level, people probably get a bit too enthusiastic about the stack pass. And there is definitely the risk of injury if you do it wrong. That's one of the things that can make this move so scary. So what I wanted to do was talk to someone who actually has an understanding of anatomy and sports recovery, who could maybe help discuss how we can apply this more safely and what the warning signs are. But Mike, with that said, I'll turn it over to you. Tell me the science, man.
So, you know, this is obviously an interesting topic because, you know, jiu-jitsu is a martial art. So it's always in the nature of jiu-jitsu is always going to have some inherent level of danger, which is okay. The key thing that I think from a physical therapy standpoint is how do we minimize unnecessary injuries, right? And that's the thing in training, you know, like we don't want to injure our training partners because like they are the ones who get us back. So in every technique, there's a way that we can apply it safely and still efficiently. And then there's ways that we can do it where it's unsafe. And a lot of times, if done effectively and efficiently, it will also be safe, you know? So we can look at this both from the anatomical perspective and then the skill perspective. So we can look at the anatomical perspectives. In general, jiu-jitsu is a flexion-based sport. What I mean that is the spine has to be able to flex or bend forward, whether literally, if you play any type of guard, anytime your knee is coming towards your chest, whether that's closed guard, open guard, there's going to be some level of rounding at the back. And then this is kind of a thing if you look into, you know, common rehab, which is, well, this isn't good for your back. You know, you need to kind of essentially be in neutral. But anyone who's done jiu-jitsu realizes that you really can't do jiu-jitsu with a neutral spine, because that's not how sport athletic works. And the same regard goes for if we go up the chain. So if, let's say, someone does put you in a stacked position, there's going to be some level of bending or flexion of your thoracic spine. So your thoracic spine is anything that attaches to the rib, which that's not really going to get injured. You're not really going to get a big thoracic spine injury. But then if you further go up the chain, now you're going to have some level of flexion of the cervical spine. So what I always tell people when I'm working with someone is I want to make sure that someone has adequate joint prerequisites before we do a position, a movement, or we're putting somewhere. So this is a thing that I do a lot. Like, let's say I'm working with someone who has a back injury or a spine injury. I'm going to prepare their body for some level of stacking, because, you know, like I said, like, we're talking about how we can stack someone safely, but that doesn't mean that our training partner is going to do what they're supposed to. And they can kind of be a little bit overzealous. So I want to make sure that when someone has a training partner that's overzealous, we can make sure that their joints can handle the rigors of sport, if that all makes sense.
Totally makes sense. You know, something that to me always stands out in jiu-jitsu in terms of where I'm the most scared when training, it is situations where my opponent has more control of my body than I do. That's always a scary situation, and that's always where injuries can happen. The thing about the stack pass, where you're kind of folding someone up like an accordion, at least that's one way to do it, and I might challenge it this episode later whether that's the best way, but the thing that makes that scary in the case of the stack pass is that you, as the person getting stacked, have precious little say in what's actually happening. There are a lot of other situations in jiu-jitsu where you may fold your body up like that. Where the mind goes is if you choose to invert, for example. But although there is a risk to that as well, at least when you're doing that, you're doing it because you chose to do it. Whereas the thing about the stack pass that makes it scary is it's pretty much all in the hands of your opponent. They chose to execute that move. They're the one trying to dump you on your head. And although there are things you can do about it to minimize risk of injury, at the end of the day, it is your opponent that is controlling your body. That's the whole point. So the thing that makes it kind of scary is that's always something that can happen. Whereas with inversions, if you, for example, have neck issues and you don't want to do inversions, then you just don't do inversions. But with the stack pass, you can't control whether your opponent is going to attempt to stack you or not. And so that's why I think it's extra important that you, as the stacker, understand how to do this technique safely to people, because especially given that you're probably talking about neck injuries, the risk to the damage that can happen there is very high, and it needs to be taken quite seriously. And something, again, I think people probably don't think enough about when it comes to safety.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And when it comes to, before we go into the specifics of the stack, a lot of things what I do when it comes to jiu-jitsu, when it comes to safety, and we almost, and this might be too broad, but generally when we're doing jiu-jitsu, there's two kind of approaches that we can take to a technique. It can be a movement-based game and a control-based game. And in general, you know, I got my black belt from Henry. He's really big on control. And you know, something Hickson had talked about where jiu-jitsu might be effective, meaning like I can play a movement-based game, which is very effective, but it might not be very efficient, which essentially with a movement-based game where you're generally thinking someone who's reliant on a little bit more athleticism, speed, they're almost like putting them like the, you know, a positional scramble. They're the type of people that they want the scramble to happen because they're good at responding to those. And I think that game, that movement-based game, tends to be where a little bit more injuries have a little bit more ability to happen, right? And again, and I'll bring this back to the stack pass. If I ever wanted to, you know, make sure an injury doesn't happen, usually in the controlled situation, I can make sure that doesn't happen. And you can look at like stuff like leg locks. Like back in the day, you know, like early 2000, heel hooks were looked at both. Danaher talks about how it was like both in an ineffective move and too dangerous. What he meant was the heel hook, which obviously we know that the heel hook can lead to bad knee and ankle injuries. But before, you know, like I think like before like 2010, there was very poor leg entanglement control. Meaning if I put you in a heel hook, I'm like, okay, well, I don't have a lot of control. So I have to apply this really, really fast or you're going to escape. So essentially I have to like try to break your leg. That's why it was dangerous. And then you look at 2010, people getting a little bit more methodical about their leg entanglement. So like me personally, like I'm the guy, like I have no issue heel hooking white belts because I'm doing it with control and I slow it, you know, I slow it down. They're never at any point of injury. And if any point that I think that they're ignorant of the move, I just don't finish. But that's based on having that control. So we can extrapolate that to the stack as well. Does that all make sense?
100%. And I think I know where you're going with this. What you've described here very much aligns with my journey in learning the stack pass. When I started off as a white belt, of course, I understood the power of this pass and the importance of this pass. And when I went to go for the stack, my goal was try to get to side control as fast as I possibly can, right? So I would be flinging people's legs around, you know, trying to turf them upside down. My goal was I want to be faster than you and get to side control and get my 3 points. But of course, my game has changed significantly since then. I have very much prescribed to the old bastard style of jiu-jitsu now, where I am all about slow control, economical jiu-jitsu, not burning energy when I don't have to. And a big change in my game was focusing more on pressure-based situations, but not like fast explosive pressure, but slow controlled pressure, where rather than being in a big rush to get to the stack pass, I try to just hold the person in this awful situation. So I'm not even necessarily putting a lot of pressure on them. I'm just trying to create a situation where their feet are off the ground, they can't connect with anything, they can't base on anything. So they're just kind of hanging out on their shoulders like a dumbass, right? And I would say that if you do that, that's probably quite safe. Where the stack gets dangerous is when the passer is trying to be explosive, fast, and they're trying to fold you up. You know, maybe they heard that whole thing about how you want to make the person's knee touch their nose. And so they just drop their whole body weight on top of you, trying to get your leg to compress down on top of your nose, right? That is where it's dangerous, where speed and body weight come into play. But I think that if you play this slower in a more static way, you know, you talked about how there's different types of control. If you play with more of a static control game where you're trying to take away their motion rather than trying to introduce more motion, I think then you can probably do this pretty safely. I would also say that it's less attribute based to that point too. So it's probably a passing style that you can keep into your later years more easily.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, when it comes to like movement-based game versus control-based game, I think we're similar ages. You know, as people get older, the control-based game is a style of jiu-jitsu that you should be able to do for longer periods of time versus the movement-based game is it's kind of a young person's game. So I'm not saying that the movement-based game doesn't have merit because obviously it does. People are very successful and you can look at so many high-level jiu-jitsu athletes that need it. I think also people who want to transition to mixed martial arts, I think that usually that movement-based game has a little bit better transfer to translate to mixed martial arts just because shorter time periods on the ground, so you have to move quicker. But that being said, I think that the control-based game, you know, obviously that's what I do, so I'm going to be a little bit more encouraging of it. But like the whole point of this conversation is doing that approach, you can approach the stack a bit safer for your training partner. So, you know, one of the things that you had said was when you were a white belt, and this happens with every technique. So usually like the first time people do the stack pass, they just try to like fling the legs to the side, which is one, it's energy inefficient. But it's also not effective. Like generally, if I go with someone, they try to fling my legs, like I'm going to be able to get my guard back. Like I'll be able to get my guard even before they pass. It's just not an effective style because they're trying to almost throw your legs. Well, it takes me a lot less energy to just pull my legs back. You know, then I think the more dangerous thing you have to worry about is if, let's say there's like a big size discrepancy, those people that, you know, when they go in for that double underhook or double, I guess it would be, yeah, you're underhooking the legs, is they just kind of like pull you up almost all onto your neck. And that's the kind of like the big thing. So they're not doing that slow, continuous pressure. They're literally just lifting your hips all the way up and now all that pressure's on the neck. That's where I find it to be dangerous, where you're applying the move way too fast and without regard to your partner. But I also don't think, again, from a movement perspective, that's very efficient because that's still reliant on you being stronger than your opponent. When I apply it, I don't think that necessarily bringing someone's knee to your nose is necessarily dangerous as long as you do two things. One, you apply it slow, which, like you said, and I 100% agree, when I play a pressure game, I'm applying the pressure slowly because this is how I make sure I have control. But the key thing that I do, because my job isn't to put their knee to their nose as like I'm trying to submit them, I'm trying to get to side control. So I always want to give my partner the option. Whenever they've had enough, they can accept the pass. They say, hey, I've had enough of this pressure. Take side control. And usually when you do it like that, when you give them that out, we're not worried about the neck injury because they always have that option of just say, okay, fine, take side control. That makes sense?
Absolutely. And that's actually, I think, the superior way to play the stack pass. You mentioned this earlier. If you are trying to do the stack pass with speed and force, the challenge that happens is, number one, you can seriously hurt your opponent if you wind up dumping them on their neck. But number two, if you're too forceful and you try to fling the person's leg over, you can quite easily get them into turtle. So instead of going to side control, you've lost control of the position because you didn't pass slowly, but rather you flung them across. And what winds up happening sometimes is they can just roll through into turtle. And in a lot of cases, that's not good for you. There's a lot of good turtle players out there, and I would much rather have someone pinned in side control. Whereas, again, if you're slow and methodical, the best way to complete the stack pass is to let the other person, as you said, decide that they want to give it up because it's pointless to be held in that position. They can't do anything. It's frustrating. It's demoralizing. It sucks to be held in a stack pass, right? So there's a lot of reasons to let the other person decide when it's time to complete the pass rather than trying to force that upon them.
And again, kind of going back to that control-based game, you know, like I said, like as long as you apply something slowly, like again, I'm a dirty leg locker. I have no issue putting a leg lock on someone because when I apply it slow, I give them that option. There's that time. So they don't have to do some type of like uncontrolled escape where they're going to hurt themselves. Or if I'm applying something slowly, I can see that and let go. Usually, I don't think there's a realistic for the stack pass. I don't think there's a poor escape because like most people can't essentially accordion themselves or they roll over, which is like what you said. That's the worry is when you're trying to just like fling their legs over their head and there's no escape. As long as you do that slow, consistent pressure, take an angle as you're slowly, incrementally getting your chest to your chest, I think it's safe. I've never hurt anyone with this position because I do it slowly.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly have never, you know, fingers crossed, to the best of my knowledge, I've never hurt anyone doing a stack pass, but I have definitely heard people tell me their stories about how it's happened to them. And usually the accusation is that the person doing the pass was too fast, too explosive, not enough control. You know, they tried to get them upside down, tried to move them with a lot of force. And also, you know, a big thing that can cause injury with the stack pass is dropping the weight on top of the person. So if you've got that person folded upside down and then you drop your body weight down on top of them when they can't do anything about it, that is a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. One thing we can consider is, as you'd pointed out, if let's say I invert, that is my decision versus the stack. I'm not deciding to get stacked. But there's still some things that the defender can do to be a little bit safer. You know, and it actually brings back to something that happened to me once where I was drilling the stack pass with my wife. So, you know, she's stacking me. But because we're drilling, I'm relaxed. And she put a little bit too much weight on me. Like she kind of dropped her weight versus being more of a continuous pressure. And there was a little pop in my back. Thankfully, it wasn't a serious back injury. But that's the type of thing that you had mentioned where what people do is they just suddenly drop their weight versus being more continuous. Now, I can't make someone be continuous, right? Because I don't want them to stack me. But there's two things that I could do. The first thing I could do is I can try to keep my back somewhat rigid. So even though the back isn't very strong in a flex position, it's not like it has no strength. So by trying to keep some rigidity is a little bit more stable than being like completely loose like a noodle, right? Because I want to resist. That allows my muscles, even if they're inefficient, to still resist that force. So then the second thing we can do when it comes to preventing the injury is, you know, we can try to keep our back somewhat rigid. So even though the back is not very strong in this flex position, it's not like it has no ability to exert force. And one of the things that we know, if the back is the most stable in a neutral position, like I said, neutral spine doesn't exist in jiu-jitsu. It's the second most stable if it's bent, if you have some level of rigidity, which is, again, I'm not active. I'm doing some level of resisting that. You know, I'm keeping my back active and I'm resisting. Second thing that we can do, and I do this very often, if somebody's stacking me, if they're drilling me, or I'm the uke and the instructor is teaching it, a lot of times what I'll do is I'm going to use one of my forearms, and I essentially create a wedge where I'm going to put that my elbow somewhere on my rib, and I'm going to put my hand somewhere on my thigh. So even if they put a lot of force, I don't have to resist solely with my back, because my forearm is going to have this some type of wedge, which one makes it, if somebody's demoing on me or drilling on me, like I'm not just sitting there in agony. But then two, again, it gives me a little bit more of a window where I can try to escape. And even though that's not a great position, some of the things you can do if you are stacked, you can try to do kind of like a shoulder walk, as opposed to, you know, let your knees go over your head. You can start shoulder walking back and trying to take out some of that stack position.
A few things I want to unpack there. You talked about the importance of keeping your spine rigid. Now, what do you mean by that? Do you mean like straightening your back out, or do you mean flexing your back muscles? What exactly does it mean to keep your spine rigid?
So with this spine, it's when we want to create stability, like we could try to brace, right? So essentially what we could do is we could do a volitional spine brace, like we're just tightening our back. But generally, again, if somebody's exerting force, so my back is in a rounded position, I can attempt to straighten it. Now, my back's likely not going to be strong enough where I'm going to be able to straighten my back if somebody is trying to stack me, just because body weight's going to beat my back. That's literally how jiu-jitsu works. But by attempting to straighten my back, I'm engaging the muscles in the back, they're your lumbar, erector spinae, where they are exerting some force to give me that buffer. So again, I don't just, you know, accordion myself and let them just smash me all the way. Was that a little bit more clear?
Yeah. So you're basically talking about straightening your spine, it sounds like. A common defense against the stack pass, actually against a lot of techniques that are similar to this too, is you try to straighten your spine out. You create what Rob Bernacki has called a spine frame, where you basically lengthen your spine and you try to lock it straight, and that's going to make it harder for the person to fold you over.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Got it. And the other thing too that you bring up is a great point. I mean, if you use a part of your body as a wedge, you can prevent the person from fully collapsing you and folding you over on top of yourself. A similar example where this comes up, and of course, this is another example of getting stacked, is if people are having trouble finishing the triangle choke because the person on top is stacking them to get out. Common piece of advice that is often given is to, you know, prevent your own knee from touching your face. And you can do that in a variety of ways, by, for example, framing off of your own knee, by changing the angle. But the idea being that one of your options is you insert something in there so that your knee can never come down low enough to actually collapse you completely. And I think that's what you're saying with that second option, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Because jiu-jitsu works for a reason. It's physics and body weight. So if I can do something to give, like I can use something rigid of my body, like my forearm, which isn't, it's going to be strong within that axial compressed position, that's going to make the position slightly less uncomfortable. I kind of figured that out by accident. Like I remember I had an instructor who was demoing on me, and you know, usually when they demo, you're not fighting back, and usually they're keeping you there and they're talking. I'm like, this sucks. So I just started doing that so I could like be less miserable while they're teaching the move. And I was like, oh, wow, this is actually pretty effective in keeping me safe.
Yeah, I've definitely had people do that to me, too. And as a stack passer, it is very frustrating when you go for the stack pass and people straighten out their spine like that. One thing that I've often done as the stack passer is these days when I try to stack someone, I'm actually usually doing it from standing, rather than doing it from just being on my knees or sprawling on top of the person. And I find if I'm doing it while I'm standing, it's easier for me to keep my balance and to not drop my weight on top of the person, right? I guess the traditional way that you would look at the stack pass is you're trying to fold the person up in like an accordion, right? You're trying to put their knee down to their nose. But I've kind of changed my thinking on that, because really the most important thing to me about the stack pass is it lets you kill the other person's base completely, because you can take their feet off of the floor. And if you can hold their feet upright and they can't connect with anything, they have no base off of their feet. So the only option they have now really is to base off of their shoulders or their hands. And that's why they can do that that spine frame that you talked about, where they lengthen the spine. But I find personally, if I'm standing up and I'm kind of crouching down and digging my knees into them and I stack them that way, it's just as effective because I can prevent their feet from touching the ground. And then it's also a lot harder for them to do things like stiff arm my face or do any of that obnoxious stuff as well.
That's something I have not played with. I would play with. I think usually what I do when I stack someone is what I would do is, so as I'm getting their hips off the ground, I'll put my knee underneath their back. So same sort of frame, but now from the offensive standpoint. So I'm not, again, using my, like, hopefully that I'm not going to lose my balance. I'm going to fall on them. I have that wedge so I can keep them in that bent position. So it allows me to, again, slowly apply the pressure. There's no worry about me losing my balance. But I can definitely play with the standing stack variation, see what I think of it.
I think I saw my brother Matt studying that. I think he actually picked it up from Andre Galvao. And I think my brother referred to it as the super stack. And I quite like that idea of doing it from my feet. I think part of the reason why folks sometimes get overly aggressive trying to do the stack pass is because if you're down on your knees or if you're sprawled on the person, it's just hard to get a lot of motion going. And so people sometimes try to explode through that so they can overcome their opponent's resistance. But I find if I'm standing when I stack you, it's very hard for the person to do things like push away. And of course, if they do try to walk backwards on their shoulders, if I'm standing, I just follow them. I just walk, right? And I carry them. The other thing I found too is it helps overcome the strength of the person's legs. I mean, one of the problems with the stack pass, of course, is you're trying to control the person's legs, which are two very, very strong parts of the human body, right? It can be hard to do. And especially against someone who's much larger than you, it can be quite a challenge to stack them the traditional way, simply because it can be very hard when you're on your knees or when you're sprawling to elevate their legs up if they really don't want their legs to be elevated. Whereas I find if I'm standing, what I can do is get that underhook, get underneath the legs, like a single under or a double under. And then rather than trying to lift their leg, I just stand up. And because I've got an underhook on their leg, when I stand up, the leg comes with me. So I found that actually standing up to stack pass, not only does it feel safer for the other person and feel more effective for me, but it also makes it much easier to do it on big people because I don't need to overpower their legs as much as I normally would.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's definitely something I'm going to start to try to play with. I do find, and I know, I think you're more of a gi guy, right?
Yeah.
So I do think that the stack, to learn it correctly, is because you want to do slow pressure, that's one move I find a lot more effective in the gi, just because you have grips where you can kind of keep somebody up. I can get like a lapel grip to, again, make sure I can kind of get the angle. I definitely think a lot of injuries might happen in no gi when you try to force this, just because no gi inherently has less control. So that's when people might have to add a little bit more speed or, you know. So I definitely think this is a move you definitely want to practice this in the gi before you try to transition to no-gi.
Yeah, it's really a move that's more about control than anything else. And I'd say if there's advice I have for people wanting to practice the stack pass, it is don't make your goal to be getting the pass. Make your goal to be holding the person in that stack position for as long as you want, basically until they decide to give it up and let you pass. Right? That, I think, is a better way to train it rather than to make it fast. And the weird thing is, it actually makes your stack better. People might think, well, if I'm training with explosiveness and trying to get the technique done as fast as possible, isn't that going to make it more effective? Not really, because with the stack pass, part of the thing that makes it so powerful is if it's slow and controlled, you can kind of hold that position for as long as you want, and you can set the person down whenever it makes sense to do so. I use this a lot against people who are trying to go 100% and beat me with athleticism or speed or strength. If I can get a stack pass, I'll basically just hold them upside down until they slow down, right? And then I'll set them down gently. I find it's a very good pace changer. If someone wants to make this a game of speed and power and explosiveness, the stack pass is one of my favorite options because I can deny them that entire game plan. And I basically hold them there until they realize that's not going to work anymore. So it's also a really great way to kind of train the younger belts to not be so explosive and freaky on the bottom and to go 100%. I like to demonstrate to them that I can sit here and just hold you and you can't do anything, because in this case, if you have no base, technique is going to beat you every time.
Yeah. I think like the old school jiu-jitsu guys used to call that like cooking somebody, right? Where you're just putting that consistent pressure on them and, you know, whatever the time is. I remember exactly what you mean. You know, I'm a black belt, but I would say my passing was the kind of like the aspect of training that took me the longest, because I always tried to rush it. But like, once I slowed down, I was like, this is way better. Cause like you forget like 2 minutes, 3 minutes is like a long time. You just do that slow, consistent pressure. They can't move and they're eventually just going to be like, okay, fine. Take the pass. This sucks.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that one other pointer that I have developed for the stack pass is when you are doing the stack pass, not only do you have to make sure you're doing it safely, but you also need to look out for your opponent because you can't guarantee that they will try to escape safely. People sometimes, if you hold them upside down, they'll do crazy dumb shit. Like they might try to, you know, do a backwards roll over their neck to try to get out. So one of the things that I do now is when someone is trying to escape the stack pass, I try to just hold them again in that stack position. Part of it is because I want to cook them, as you said. I want to leave them in this undesirable position until they give up on their own. But part of it is even if my goal is not to fling your legs over and, you know, do this with power and speed. Your goal to escape, if you don't know better, might be to try to fling yourself explosively. Junior belts, for example, again, they might try to roll backwards and take the momentum and try to get back into turtle or get out. And that is risky because despite my best intentions, you might roll over your own neck. You know, I don't want you to injure yourself just as much as I don't want to injure you. So the thing I like about the slow controlled stack pass is once I get someone's feet up off the ground, yes, I want to make sure that they can't, you know, walk backwards on their shoulders. Yes, I want to make sure they can't get out from the underhooks and get their legs back. But I also want to make sure that they can't roll backwards as well into turtle or something like that. So part of what I'm doing is holding their legs to prevent them from trying to escape on their own. So again, anytime you've got a person in that kind of position, right? If someone is sort of upside down on their neck, there's a lot of reasons why you need to make sure you're taking good care of the person, even in competition, right? Even in competition, it's totally fine to play a stack pass safely like this. It's just as effective. You don't need to be going completely crazy when you're doing this move.
Yeah, and actually, a point you'd mentioned earlier is I think it's more effective to do that because, you know, if they do something stupid and then they roll, even if they don't get hurt, they're in the turtle, which we don't necessarily want. You want to put them in that position. You want to get to side control because side control is a more inherent advantage position for the top guy.
Now, what do you do to prevent all of this from happening to you? I mean, you already brought up some good points, right? If they're going for the stack pass, you want to straighten your spine out. You want to walk back on your shoulders. You want to have your hands or forearms kind of in front of you so that if the person does try to stack you upside down and put your knee onto your nose, you want to make that a little bit hard for them to do so. Any other pointers or things that you would suggest to help people defeat the stack pass and maybe have it happen to them more safely as well?
So that we can look at both the skill and then the physical capacity. So the skill thing we could do is you have to think about what guards might put you in a position where you could be stacked. So again, because, you know, I'm a physical therapist, I work with a lot of people who are injured. When people are coming back from a neck injury or spine injury, like one of the things I do is we talk about what positions you have to be careful of. Unfortunately, if someone has a neck injury, again, if you're worried about this, you have a neck injury, back injury, whatever, I actually don't like the close guard for that reason. Because if I'm playing close guard, my attack is primarily going to be close guard, is going to be like a triangle or an armbar. Now, I know there's other things, but those are two major attacks. And the way you deal with a triangle or an armbar is a stack. So already, right off the bat, that's one thing you should be careful of. Anytime you're playing like an open guard where your legs are really high, it's going to be easier for people to come underneath you versus if your legs are lower, obviously they can't go low. Now, you might be putting yourself in a position where they might not be able to go underneath you, and then they might do a different pass like a Toriando or they pin your legs, but that's the game of jiu-jitsu, right? Like if you take away one option, there's something else. But it's important to have that awareness. If you're dealing with a guy who's a good stack passer, I don't want to have my legs too high because it's going to be easier for you to get underneath. So that's one. Second thing we do is let's say, you know, someone does start to stack. An easy thing you want to do is you don't want to let your legs be light. So one of the things you could do is you could try to engage your glutes, almost like you're trying to do like a glute bridge, right, where you're trying to elevate your leg. So when you engage your glutes, it's going to make your legs heavy and your spine straight. So even before they roll you up, your spine's already straight. Your glutes are, so now your legs are going to feel very, very heavy. And that's going to be a very big deterrent for them to continue the stack.
Yeah. Something that I would expand on there too. I've talked in the past about how in jiu-jitsu, you generally don't want to be a tetherball, right? You don't want to be in a position where you are tied to your opponent and they can move you around and there's not much you can do about it. Some common examples of this, again, the stack pass is a great example of this, where if you've got your legs up on their shoulders, you're kind of tethered to them. There's not much you can do. They're the ones dictating the motion. And like you said, I try to be very cognizant of when people are fighting for the underhook and to get under my legs, because if they can elevate my legs up, then suddenly I'm in this incredibly awkward position that's hard to defend from. So I think being preventative there and trying to avoid getting all tethered up on your opponent where they can move you around is a great idea. This kind of idea will also prevent you from getting stacked from other positions like the triangle. Common mistake with people doing triangles is they will try to throw up a triangle on someone who has perfect posture. And what winds up happening is the person just moves you around at their own discretion at that point. I mean, in order to do a triangle properly, you need to have the person's posture broken down so they can't stack you. There's a lot of moves like that. And after training for a while, you develop the sensitivity around this. And you start to realize when someone is going for that stack and you deny them that. Because again, if they can get under your legs, if they can lift you up, suddenly they can control where your body can go and you have very minimal control of it yourself.
Yeah. You know, and then piggybacking on what you're saying about the triangle, like let's say I'm attacking an armbar. A lot of times when people throw they do a classic closed guard armbar, they throw the leg over and their far leg is going to be clamped on the neck. But the problem is when, if you are defending, if you can maintain posture, that means you can stack me. So one of the things that I always tell people when they're doing the closed guard is when you clamp that leg, when you're clamping that leg, it should be on their head. Because if let's say you're defending the armbar and I can smash your head all the way down, it's going to be very difficult for you to get the posture needed to stack me.
Yeah, great advice. I remember learning specifically about how you can kind of flare your leg a little bit to really clamp down on the person's neck. And that's so helpful because, yeah, common problem with trying to submit from the guard, especially triangles and arm bars, but also omoplatas as well, is that getting stacked is an option, right? In fact, in general, this is one reason why if you're smaller, you never want to assume that you should just go for submissions from the bottom. You want to be real sure, because if the person is bigger and stronger, once you latch onto them, if you don't actually have the submission perfect, now you're tethered to them and they can move you around however they want. With arm bars, of course, this happens from the bottom. Again, if you don't break their posture, triangles are notorious for this. Omoplatas, I've talked about this as well, where I was trying to omoplata a much bigger guy one time and he just kind of picked me up and just spiked me on the back of my neck, just folded me over completely. It was one of the scariest things that ever happened to me in jiu-jitsu. The problem is with a lot of those attacks, if you are tied up to the other person and they're bigger than you, you can wind up going for the ride. And again, that's scary because you don't really have control anymore over what happens next is safe. And that's why I think, especially for smaller people, before you latch on and tether to a person, you want to really make sure their posture is screwed up because you cannot afford to let them move you around like that.
I think a lot of people forget, like, the guard is inherently a defensive position first. Like, it's called the guard. Like, the point is, like, I don't care, you know, even though we have offensive options from our back, it's still not as good as being on top. And I think that sometimes when people do sports jiu-jitsu, they kind of forget that. Like, my job first should be like, let's stay safe. Let's stop the guard from being passed. And then we attack and sweep second.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I know that, again, what is it Chris Howder said about the seductive nature of the guard? It's fun to play the guard. It's a complicated puzzle to solve. And because we spend so much time focusing on that, especially at the fundamental levels, I think people sometimes overweight the importance of the guard and they get too comfortable hanging out from there. But from my perspective, you know, submitting from the guard is the lowest of my priorities if I'm on the bottom. I want to get up on top. That is my number one priority. If there's a submission there, I'll go for it. But I have to be really sure that I'm actually going to get it. Because usually if you kind of think about the risks that can happen from trying to submit someone off of the bottom, usually the risk of a failed submission is pretty bad. So for example, armbar, right? If I try to armbar you from guard, yeah, if I get the tap, that's great. But if it goes wrong, I'm probably going to wind up in bottom side control. Same with the triangle. That's a good result. The worst result is I could get stacked on my neck and injured somehow. So it's always something to think about that although these are an option, they're probably not the best option. There's a reason why we consider the mount and back control to be these way better positions. It's because from there, your submission options are a lot higher percentage. Whereas when you are fighting off of your back on the bottom, no matter how good you are, it's always going to be harder to get a submission from there. So I generally encourage people to think of submission from the guard as kind of a last resort. I would much rather people focus on getting out of there and getting on top.
Yeah, I remember thinking of, now granted, this was mixed martial arts, this wasn't jiu-jitsu, but I was in an MMA fight and I go for an armbar, I think twice, and the guy slammed his way out. Now, I didn't get injured. You know, it's a fight, you know, I'm worried about other stuff, but that's a thing you have to consider. I think it was like 4 or 5 months ago, there was a UFC card where there were two wins where a guy was slammed from the closed guard. One guy, he went for an armbar, the guy picked him up and slammed him on his head. Even if that is not legal in jiu-jitsu, you know, again, whatever people train for, self-defense or mixed martial arts, like, it's still a thing. Like, I can still pick you up and slam you on your head, which is a, if you take like being stacked, it's like, you know, that much worse, right? Because now it's an explosive movement where you're landing on your head. So it's, even if you're in jiu-jitsu and that's not legal, like, you still should be prepared for that, because whether A, you're in a fight, or B, you know, like, just because it's illegal, that doesn't mean people won't do it. Like, I've been in tournaments where people, they slam someone, they're like, oh, I didn't know I could do that. Well, yeah, that person lost because they slammed their opponent, but the person who got slammed, they might have won by DQ, but they might have had a neck injury, concussion, or whatever. So, like, that still sucks.
Well, not just that, too, but even if the person doesn't intend to slam you, it can still happen. Still happens all the time, right? I mean, if I am clinging on top of you like a little front-facing backpack and I'm trying to submit you and my body weight is hanging off of you, it's going to be pretty hard for you to keep your balance. You know, if you jump a triangle on someone or jump an armbar, you can't guarantee that person just going to sit there and hold you up while you submit them. There's a good chance they're going to slip, they're going to fall, they're going to land on top of you. So all of that stuff has to be done with extra care. And again, in these cases, even if you are in a rule set where this stuff is illegal, and even if your opponent doesn't want to do it to you, that doesn't mean it'll never happen. Accidents happen. People slip, people fall. I remember one time, again, I almost had this particular stacking injury happen to me because I was trying to invert under a bigger guy and he zigged and I zagged. I went to invert and I folded myself up and he sprawled on me right at that time. But luckily, this guy had really good body awareness and he knew that something bad was going to happen, and he was able to kind of get out of the way and prevent his weight from just landing down on top of me. But that kind of stuff happens. Even in a completely slam-free rule set, there's still the possibility that that kind of thing could happen to you. So, I mean, I don't like to take risks around that kind of stuff. I don't like to assume that I can get into these kind of dangerous positions and that the rules will protect me, regardless of the other person's intent. I think it's best to, again, try to keep your neck safe where you can.
Yeah, and again, one of the things, we're kind of like focusing this conversation on macro injuries where, like, again, someone folds their neck or, you know, something like that. But I think it's very common with a lot of jiu-jitsu athletes where they have these micro traumas where it's not that they got stacked once. It's the fact that they do it over and over and over again. And, you know, there's those people that there's like very flexible, like, oh, I can get stacked. But it's like, so like, how many times are you getting stacked before the accumulation of that leads to the injury? So that's another thing. So one, you know, like, just because you have the capacity where you can be stacked doesn't mean you should just let it happen. And then two, again, I'm a physical therapist, so I'll say it, but just because you didn't get injured, you know, like, mostly, honestly, when I work with people who have back injuries or neck injuries that are jiu-jitsu athletes, it's usually more this chronic degeneration where they just keep letting themselves get stacked, or they get their neck cranked and, you know, they didn't tap and now their neck doesn't move that much. And now they're that much more prone to get injured in these positions because their neck or their back doesn't do what it did, you know, when they were in their 20s.
That is a great point. I mean, you know this because I was just telling you about this, but a week or two ago, my shoulder was injured and there wasn't a moment that happened where it injured. It's not like someone kimura'd me and ripped my arm off and, oh, I heard something pop or anything like that. It's just, I went to class and it was fine and nothing real, no one like attacked my shoulder or anything. And I went home and I thought, my shoulder kind of like, it hurts more than I would expect. I went back to class the next day and I trained again. I was very slow, very safe, tried to kind of not do anything stupid. And again, nothing terrible happened to my shoulder, but my shoulder hurt even a little bit more. And so the next time I went to class again, I babied it really carefully. But afterwards, even though nothing happened, my shoulder really started to hurt. So I thought, okay, something unusual is happening here. I went to a physiotherapist and, you know, they did a bunch of checks on me. And what they basically said is the interesting thing that they found is my arm that was injured is my right arm is significantly weaker than my left arm, at least the shoulder is. And I'd never noticed this before. And his thought was, you know, it's possible that there has just been some sort of degrading injury that's been happening for a while that you never noticed. And your arm is just atrophied and weakened because you've been accommodating to work around it. And that's, I think, an example of what you're talking about, where there wasn't a moment where my arm just gave out. Rather, it was just kind of gradual until it got to the point where I couldn't really train anymore. And then, yeah, when I went in to have the physio take a look at it, it wasn't some cut and dry thing where they said, oh, yeah, you tore your rotator cuff. It was rather more just, this is probably the accumulation of a lot of wear and tear and you kind of not really using this shoulder as much as you probably should be because you didn't realize that you were sort of favoring it. So I thought that was interesting. I don't know that you're the doctor. You tell me if that's a good diagnosis or if he was out to lunch.
No. I mean, that's definitely a thing. So if he ran you through some tests and, you know, like the better I get as being a physical therapist, like it's funny, like the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. So he probably ran you through some tests and nothing popped up that was very significant. So likely you didn't have a lot of shoulder laxity. So it is, and then just based on yourself, did not have a clear mechanism of injury, that just long-term chronic degenerative shoulder is definitely very possible. And I think, you know, you're master's athlete at this point, you're a little bit smarter. A lot of jiu-jitsu athletes are real dummies and they would be in your situation for months and they're like, oh yeah, I just put my hand in my belt and I just won't use it. And I remember before I was a physical therapist, like I did that once. And you know what happened? I kept hurting my shoulder and I kept delaying my return to sport. I mean, I always tell people, like if there's anything that you can do to have a longevity in the sport, is manage your injuries early, because an acute injury is much easier to manage. Like when someone's like, oh yeah, I had a shoulder injury or a neck injury for 5 years, it's going to be a lot longer to get that shoulder or that neck or that body part feeling better, because there's been so much wear and tear at that point. It just, the prognosis is not as good and the length of time is going to be longer. So, and usually like with jiu-jitsu, it's not that like people just get, I mean, it does happen. People might get bored and they're like, I don't want to do this anymore. This is especially common for like, you know, competitive athletes, is they start to accumulate all of these small injuries and they kept worse and worse. And now they're, you know, they have a shoulder injury. Now their shoulder is like 99%. Now it's 95%. Now it's like 50%. And I'm sure every listener is seeing those older black belts where their game is so limited, not because of their jiu-jitsu simples, because their body won't let them do things anymore. And then it's the athlete that like, well, I can't compete anymore because my body won't let me. There's too many injuries. So get your injuries addressed. Too many people, and this is my soapbox, too many people rely on like social media rehab and like, I don't actually want to go to a physical therapist or a medical doctor. I don't trust them. I'm just going to, you know, take some peptides. I'm just going to do some stuff I see online and it'll be fine. I'm like, no, don't do that.
Yeah. The stakes are too high to fail to take this stuff seriously. Friend of the show, Matt Kirtley, he's been on the podcast many times as a black belt. I think he teaches at the Inverted Gear Academy, last I checked. But something that he said was his greatest jiu-jitsu regret is the way he trained at white belt, because he was at the time, you know, young and dumb, like most of us guys. And we just went in there thinking this is Fight Club and we're going to scrap and give it 110%. And he said he racked up a ton of completely unnecessary, avoidable injuries that still plague him to this day. And his big regret is accumulating all of those injuries for basically no gain. You know, it's one thing if you get injured in the finals of a black belt world championship. It's another thing if you get injured on your third day of white belt jiu-jitsu. And that happens a lot, right? And this is part of the reason why I wanted to have this chat, because nothing scares me more than two white belts rolling together. Because at that point, they don't know how to take care of each other. I mean, we talked about the stack pass here, right? If you put me in there with the most lunatic white belt you can find, I'm still not that concerned, because look, if I get them to a stack pass, as I mentioned earlier, I know how to hold them safely. but I also know that they don't know how to hold themselves safely. So I'm going to expect they're going to try to backflip over their neck or do something crazy, and I'm just not going to let them do that. Whereas if you get two white belts, they're in there thinking that this is Fight Club and they're going to do anything they can to win. They probably, if they're young, they might not have ever had a serious, devastating injury before, so they might not understand how bad it's going to get if they really hurt themselves. And so they'll do crazy stuff. I remember one time at my old club, which I don't train at now, and you can probably guess why I'm not there anymore, but I saw two white belts sparring just kind of unsupervised, and one of them just picked up the other, or like one of them got stuck in an armbar, and the armbar E, I guess, just picked up the other guy while in an armbar and just spiked him on the top of his head to get out. It's like, for fuck's sake. But of course, you know, they don't know any better. These guys probably didn't even know that slams were not legal at this point because they were too new. And so again, two white belt sparring unsupervised is the scariest thing in all of jiu-jitsu. That's why I hate this culture where they say, oh, you can't call a higher belt out to roll. And that's the dumbest thing, right? If you are a brand new white belt, your best bet is to roll with people more experienced than you, because although you're probably going to get turned into a pretzel, at least you're not going to get hurt in the process.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It's even worse if you have two white belts, they're doing takedowns. You're like, dear God, please. Please. Obviously, for me, from a business standpoint, it might be good, but like, no, please don't do that. That's terrible. It's terrifying.
But it's not good if they get injured and they never come back again, right? I mean, I'll tell you a dumb white belt takedown story. When young Steve was in his 20s and he was like a zero or one stripe white belt, I found another young guy in his 20s who was also a zero or one stripe white belt. And we just decided, fuck it, we're going to do judo today. And of course, being the brilliant white belts that we are, you can imagine that this ended in the worst possible way possible. I got his thumb in my eye socket, removed a piece of my eye. It freaked me out like nothing. I looked in the mirror and there was like a visible piece of my eye missing. And because I am such a genius, I went to the hospital, got it checked out, and I was like, I can probably go back and train again tomorrow. So I put on an eye patch and I went and I trained tomorrow, which is like the dumbest thing. Of course, it didn't stay on at all. I mean, in retrospect, I probably could have got an infection, probably could have lost my eye. I was a fucking idiot. And I wish in retrospect, I wasn't that dumb. But all I can say is to all of those young white belts out there right now who take their training incredibly seriously, just understand that accumulating injuries at your white belt stage is like the worst long-term decision you can make. If your goal is you want to be like everyday Pohada world champion guy, the worst thing that you can do is rack up injuries at white belt, because that will absolutely screw up your performance at the later belts where it matters and where you know better.
Yeah. You know, a funny white belt story. I was doing nuggies. He didn't know he was a black belt. And I think he was like a one stripe white belt or something. He sees me and he probably thinks I'm a white belt. I'm very unassuming. You know, I catch him a few times and I had him in a choke and he's like, man, I didn't want to tap. He's like, Khabib didn't tap. I'm like, dude, you're a white belt. You're not Khabib. Like, completely different story. You know, I just had him in a rear naked choke or whatever, but it's like, dude, like, this is not the UFC. You're not in a world champion. He ended up like, he matured and, you know, I do like him. It was just, but that was like that was my first interaction with him. I'm like, this dude's terrible. Not from a terrible from a skill perspective, but just that attitude. Just to reiterate the point, jiu-jitsu, there's inherent danger with jiu-jitsu. And again, I'm okay with that. If we try to make it too safe where injuries are not possible, it might not be an effective art anymore. So there's always inherent danger in jiu-jitsu. That being said, there's injuries that can be avoidable, and that's what we want to do. Like, I think ultimately we want to make sure that people can have longevity in the sport, avoid those unnecessary injuries so that you could do jiu-jitsu for a long period.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say one other thing, right, on the topic of doing the slow, controlled, methodical stack pass. There is no feeling in jiu-jitsu better than having someone give up because you just held them upside down in a stack pass.
Yeah, well,
you don't need to pass. You don't need to submit. I do this to like the MMA kids all the time. They come in and they got their white or their blue belt and they're like, they're here to scrap. As soon as I get under their legs, I just hold them upside down. And you can see them go through like these stages of grief in their head. You know, they're going from like denial to anger to loss to eventually they go to acceptance and they're just like, okay, I guess this is just my life now. I'm not going to get out of here. You're not going to let me get out of here. So I have to give up, not because I'm in a submission, but because otherwise you're enough of a lunatic that you will hold me upside down for the rest of the night. And I realized, you know, that's the kind of jiu-jitsu I actually want to train, right? The thing that appealed to me about jiu-jitsu way back in the day when I was trying to figure out what martial art I wanted to train was I saw, like so many others from my generation, I saw Hoist in the UFC and I heard the marketing. And the thing that appealed to me about jiu-jitsu was it wasn't just that it was effective. And it wasn't just that it's effective for small, unathletic people like me. It was also that I can beat you without me getting hurt and without you getting hurt. And that was important to me because I'm the type of person who does not take any joy in hurting other people. I don't see the appeal. I never want it to happen. And so the idea of being able to de-escalate a situation without hurting the other person was so appealing to me. And I think that's when you really, I mean, I know this is like old ass black belt talking about shit. And I know that we probably lost all the kids here, but that to me is the thing that appeals so much about jiu-jitsu. When just effortlessly, you just shut someone down. They just can't do anything. No one's at risk. It's completely safe, but they have to give up because there's no other option. That to me is like the spirit of jiu-jitsu, at least the vision of jiu-jitsu that I have anyway.
Yeah, that's how you know you're a black belt, when you can like effortlessly flow with someone and they're trying to everything in their power to stop you and they can't. Like, that is what I think in me, that's the essence of jiu-jitsu. And things like that, this slow stack where they're just like, this sucks, like just take the pass. So that's what you want.
You know who's the king out of this? Gant Grimes from Texas. We had him on the podcast here. I never met him in person until December when we got together at a camp. And he is notorious for this. Like, he's got this, and I'm going to say this because I know he's going to listen. He's got this bullshit he does where he does like no arm side control, but he's so freaking good at it just from years and years of like ecological training there. He'll just basically beach on top of you like a whale. And there is nothing you can do. You're basically there until he decides, like, he gets bored of it. It's that to me is like good jiu-jitsu, right? Is just completely effortless control. It's not about who can explode faster out of a submission or who gets the tap the quickest. It's can you control and de-escalate the situation and make it entirely your own without any risk to you or even to the other person?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Well, awesome, Mike. Great chat, man. Anything else you wanted to add on the topic of stack passing or safety in general?
I would say, I mean, just like a quick thing other than that, if as a physical therapist, if someone is worried, you know, taking care of your joints, even if it's not injured, is important. Making sure your joint can move in every degree it's supposed to, so you have that buffer. Like I said, a lot of times you have that, you know, master's black belt who's so broken, they're just more easy to get to that limit where their spine or their neck doesn't move. That's a problem. So, you know, if you're a young athlete, take care of your joints. Maintain the mobility. I always tell people when it comes to longevity, in addition to having adequate mobility, make sure you have a good strength and conditioning program, because we want to make sure that our joints have the ability to tolerate jiu-jitsu. Like, jiu-jitsu is not necessarily good for our body, so we have to do something to maintain our body so we can do jiu-jitsu for a long period of time.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks as always. And that's as good a transition as any, I think. I mean, if people are in need of physio because they're trying to get back on the mats, or if people want help building a routine to kind of keep themselves safe and keep their joints strong, can't think of anyone better in the sport than you, man. I mean, you're an expert in this and you're a jiu-jitsu black belt, right? The challenge I hear from a lot of people is when they go to physio, they wind up with a physiotherapist who doesn't know jiu-jitsu. And so they don't really understand things. And so their advice is usually, well, just don't do that ever again. And of course, you know, jiu-jitsu people, they're not going to like being told that. I know that you've helped a lot of people get back on the mat safely, return to sport, and be just as good as they were before. If people want to work with you or check out your content, how do they go about doing that?
Best way to reach out is going to be Instagram. It's the word Dr_kickass. I think I have the same thing on Facebook. And then from there, there's an easy link. You can find my website where I have some joint training courses. I have courses for physical therapists who want to get a little bit more information. Like, let's say they want to work with jiu-jitsu athletes, but they don't really know much about jiu-jitsu. It kind of like helps bridge the gap. Like, I can't give them a black belt, but I can kind of give them a little bit more. So if they are working with a jiu-jitsu athlete, they're a little bit more prepared.
The other thing too, I love about your social is the injury breakdowns. I mean, you do these great breakdowns where you take a look at, you know, high profile injuries that happened and you explain exactly where it went wrong, what happened, you know, what causes that kind of injury, how to rehab it, how to prevent it. It's very unique content. There are a lot of people who purport to be, you know, fitness experts. There's a lot of people who purport to be jiu-jitsu experts, but there are not many people who specialize in high level jiu-jitsu physiotherapy and rehab. So definitely recommend giving your stuff a follow. As always, I'll put links to all of that stuff in the show notes. So your website, your Instagram, all of the other good stuff. I'll also put a link to our stuff. Everything we make lives at bjjmentalmodels.com. The podcast is and has always been entirely free. No ads, no nothing. You can get it all, again, at the website. You can also load it into pretty much any podcast player from any podcast directory you like. Just go and search for BJJ Mental Models. Our newsletter is also about to cross 10,000 subscribers. It's an amazing amazing free resource. If you listen to the podcast and wish you could get detailed notes on these conversations and kind of more expanded thought pieces, that's where you go. So the newsletter, again, you can also sign up from the website. And beyond that, if you want to kick it up to the next level, BJJ Mental Models Premium is how we pay the bills around here. If you sign up for Premium, it's a monthly subscription. There's no lock-in or anything. You can leave, cancel at any time. You get a few things. First of all, you get access to our audio course library. At this point, we've got over 100 hours of audio courses on there from some of the best minds in the sport. We try to do things different and in a very unique way. We don't do a lot of video instructional simply because there's a lot of that already. But by doing audio, we can focus on talking about things like strategy, concepts, mental models, tactics, philosophy, mindset. So that's the kind of stuff that you'll get there from some of the best coaches and athletes in the sport as well. It's not just me talking into a mic the whole time. We also have an ever-growing family of premium podcasts. We've got an amazing podcast called The Highest Levels, hosted by Emily Kwok and Joe Hannon. They actually just had Marcelo Garcia on as a guest. It was just an amazing chat. Went deep into all of the battles that Marcelo's had recently in his personal life. I'm not familiar with any other situation where Marcelo was spoken at length about stuff to this extent. So I'm just so glad that we were able to bring that to the community. There's also other premium podcasts on there as well. And of course, if you go up into our higher tiers, we can get like black belt world champions breaking down your footage directly. So if you're not getting enough coaching directly from in the gym, BJJ Mental Models Premium is the best resource to do that. Send us just a short clip of yourselves rolling. We'll give you high level black belt feedback. And I think for most people, they'll be quite surprised at how valuable even just a quick review of a short 2-minute roll can be. And we have a video library now. So if you join our coaching tier, you will get our video library. If you're tired of hearing me talk and you want to know what the shit looks like, BJJ Mental Models Premium, join our coaching tier or higher, and you will get access to our video library produced by Brother Matt, actually, of all people. So hope everyone likes all of that stuff. And again, free trial, try it for 7 days. If you don't like it, cancel, won't cost you anything. But all of that is at bjjmentalmodels.com. And Mike, just like your stuff, I'll put a link to all of that in the show notes to make it easy for people. But Mike, man, thanks so much for coming by. Really glad that we were able to have a talk like this. This is my favorite kind of jiu-jitsu conversation where we've got a very relatable problem that people just don't really think or talk enough about. And I think we were able to add a lot of value by discussing it at length. So thanks so much for coming by, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is always fun.
Always fun, sir. And thanks to the listeners as well. Always fun to have you here too. I'll talk to you next week. Take care.